You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Yeah, I'd like to welcome you to our conference this morning, which is devoted to the merit-based incentive payment system. A word probably very few of you could recite, also known as MIPS. And MIPS was part of the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act of 2015, or MACRA. And to both physicians and to many in Congress, the first thoughts about MACRA are that it ended the Sustainable Growth Rate, or SGR, a policy enacted in 1997 that spun out of control a few years later and occupied Congress for over 10 years with short-term fixes to finally get a handle on it. But MACRA not only ended SGR, but it also put in place reforms in physician payment for the Medicare program. Most attention has been to the bonus for physicians participating in advanced alternative payment models. And as I say, most attention, it's not so much the number of physicians getting a 5% bonus, but that here was Congress speaking, pointing the way to how it wanted the Medicare program to evolve. And this was a very broad consensus in Congress, and I think very much applauded throughout the healthcare system. But MACRA also included MIPS, which applies to physicians not participating in advanced alternative payment models. It streamlined some existing pay-for-performance programs in Medicare. Now, MIPS has had what you might call a rocky start. CMS delayed parts of it and exempted very large numbers of physicians in smaller practices. Physicians raised concerns about the burden and the costs required to do the reporting required in MIPS. And policy analysts examined the track record of the measures and raised concerns about their relationship to the quality and cost goals and whether they reliably identified good and bad performers. In January, MedPAC voted to recommend to Congress that MIPS be eliminated and that a new voluntary value program be established that would measure the performance of groups that physicians would form on a voluntary basis. This conference is organized to discuss the recent experience with MIPS and ideas to address its shortcomings. Our initial announcement listed Joe Grogan as the opening speaker. He had to drop out because of a scheduling issue, so we decided just to proceed with our two panels. The first panel is going to discuss how MIPS is working. It's going to focus on the experience of different types of physician practices with MIPS. And the second panel will discuss ways to reform MIPS. The first panel will be moderated by Kavita Patel, who practices medicine at Johns Hopkins Medicine and contributes to our work at the USC Brookings Schaefer Initiative for Health Policy as a non-resident fellow at Brookings.
Thank you, Paul. And I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to briefly introduce our panel. Each panelist does have slides, and as a result, I couldn't help but put in, I was able to get some slides myself, but as Paul mentioned, and I know there are a lot of you watching on the webcast, we are going to talk about how MIPS is actually working on the ground, but we can't help but offer a potential foray into some solutions, or at least trying to bridge to our second panel, which Paul will be leading. So starting to my right, we have Valinda Rutledge, and they're in the order of appearance as well, the Vice President of Public Payer Health Strategy from the Care Coordination Institute of the Greenville Health System in South Carolina, Sherry Erickson, the Vice President of Governmental Affairs and Medical Practice at the American College of Physicians, Aaron Liss, the Director of Strategy and Business Development at Tennessee Oncology, and Tim Groniger, Senior Vice President of Development and Strategy at Caravan Health. All of these people have much longer bios associated, but in the interest of getting us to what we want to do, they can each talk about kind of their respective roles during their presentations. I decided to put in a couple of very pragmatic slides around. Uh-oh, here we go. Let's see. I just have to pull up the PowerPoint myself. Okay. That sounds like I'm being a little... All right. So, all right, every single one of you have to pull up the PowerPoint. And then somebody's going to make it sync with the screen. So what I decided to do while we're waiting for it to come up... I mean... It's on full screen. It's on my full screen.
On the presenter.
Ah.
Sorry.
Okay, everybody has to do this? Okay. All right, I was a chief resident, so I'm ready for all the... Okay, so here we go. So I wanted to just do this as a ground refresher because I think that everybody on both of these panels are extreme experts for the MIPS program, but just wanted to kind of offer a little bit of like level setting for the categories. And by the way, last week, the administration released the proposed rule around the physician fee schedule and the QPP program and a number of other changes. So there's actually some tweaks and adjustments to even what you see here. But needless to say, as Paul mentioned, this was all an attempt to make something better than what was previously there in various programs. And some of us might talk about this. I wanted to just bring up, I practice the plurality of my time in an employed community-based, not an academic, community-based primary care setting that is on fee-for-service. 98% of our revenue is fee-for-service. 40% of my practice across 8 primary care physicians and 4 specialists is actually Medicare. So there were many of us, but we all roll up into one big tax ID number across many sites. So because of our performance and volume and thresholds, we actually are all contributing to MIPS. I did look up my NPI quickly to see if I could be out of MIPS. That was the first thing I did, and unfortunately, I wasn't. So I'm going to briefly show you a couple of how we do things internally. We were on Epic. I've just been interacting with our IT team over the last several days to understand what our workflows are, what our investments have been. I've asked to quantify what our financial investment has been to just stand up the MIPS requirements. And basically, I was told that they were too large or too scattered to really congregate and put into $1 amount. But needless to say, it's a lot less than what our bonus that we received was, which was approximately a 2% kind of MIPS adjustment. And it's not even fair to call it a bonus. It's really just kind of meeting some of these performance goals. I just decided to take some of the things that I had to do at the staff level and then what we have to do to coordinate the builds in our electronic health record. And because of changes in requirements, we're going to have to just keep doing these continuous changes and builds. I'm not going to read the slides to you. I think the more interesting thing, and I'm not expecting you to read, this is my personal dashboard. And you'll see that I have a lot of reds in areas, which tell you what probably a practical practicing physician experience is. There are some things that have denominators that don't apply because they're not relevant to my population, but because of our need to build across an entire system, they're put onto our dashboard. I bring up the granularity of my personal dashboard, one, to drive home the point that as a practicing physician, I actually don't ever use this dashboard. It's completely meaningless to me, especially since there are so many things that don't apply to me personally, yet this is considered customized for myself. And then at the same time, I think one of the greatest opportunities, and Tim Groniger and others at Brookings and I have discussed this, is that I don't really know quite what to do to improve in areas where I do have kind of red and I need to go into green, like closing referral loops for specialist reports, which I feel like is part electronic, but much of our work, especially at a place like Johns Hopkins where we get a lot of referrals and then send out a lot of referrals back, is done over fax. So there are things that are just very kind of complicated. I don't want to go through each of these steps, but did want to show you what a very practical, on a daily basis, kind of what our view as a practicing physician might look like. And then I do have the ability to do a lot of things inside of my health record to kind of look at patients and look at things. Quite honestly, I don't have the time, nor do I have the motivation to do it. And I asked just to kind of put a little finer point on this, some of the recent changes around the MIPS program that have been proposed last week, which I think in general are positive changes. My question to our system leadership was, what do we sacrifice what are we not going to do because we need to do some of this activity around getting the dashboards up, getting the workflows right. Something as simple as measuring blood pressure alone and reporting on that quality metric can take approximately, 200 hours of kind of time on the electronic side. And then on the physician workflow side can take even 5 to 6 times that. So we've spent almost 1,000 hours, like an aggregate across our practice and across different personnel, to really understand how do we implement measuring and then controlling hypertension. So I bring that up because at the same time, we're also trying to be, we are a level one accountable care organization. And the truth is that a lot of the activities we're doing in MIPS, frankly, are coming at a cost of our ability to advance in other, I would say, quote, risk-taking population health-based models, because it is a fixed-sum game. There's only so much time that I can ask of fellow doctors and medical assistants and front desk schedulers, and then there's only so many resources that we have, primarily on our IT side, to actually help us do some of this. So with that, I just offered a little bit of a pragmatic view from my perspective, but I think a lot of my colleagues would echo this and kind of say the same thing. So I'll hand it over to Valinda. We're going to go through, each speaker is going to have kind of our presentation, and then we'll have a Q&A period afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Abby. I don't know if I could figure out how to pull the slides off.
I'm sorry.
I'm Valinda Rutledge. I'm the VP of Public Payer Strategy at Greenville Health System. Thank you. There we go.
Is it on?
Okay. Yes. Great. Greenville Health System is a part of a new health company. We recently merged with Palmetto Health, so GHS and Palmetto Health has come together. As you can see, we're one of the largest systems in South Carolina. We have a total of close to 2,800 physicians in our CIN, and about half of them are employed and half of them are independent physicians. So that's pretty unique. A lot of CINs either have a predominant of employed physicians or it may be much smaller with a large amount of independent physicians. What also makes this unique is because South Carolina, it's a little bit different than the Northeast. We have a large amount of rural areas. So we have 32% of our practices that's in our CIN is in, you would classify as small practices in rural areas. So the ongoing rural challenge that we've had in MIPS is that the EMR vendors require significant upgrade fees and rate increases in order to have upgrades in the product to be able to report MIPS requirement. So not only do you have the initial investment that you have in putting the EMR in, that you also have yearly upgrade fees that are pretty substantial for rural providers. Second, in quality outcome measures, the absence of a risk adjustment is not addressing the older and sicker populations that you currently see in the rural area. As you know, currently in MIPS, smaller practices have, you can get a small practice bonus, but that still does not level the playing field in the competition between the rural and urban practices that you will see. Also, there are very few alternative payment models that urban providers can actually participate in. The fourth issue is a lack of connectivity that many rural providers have with other rural providers. Many of the SNFs that are in rural areas lack any type of EMR. So that makes it very difficult for rural providers to connect with other rural providers in their area to be able to have effective integration activities. Also, rural providers have been running lean for decades, and they simply don't have enough staff to be able to address all the MIPS complexity. Many of them, as you know, may have one or two providers in the office. may have one mid-level provider and a part-time office staff. So that's a very lean operation that makes it very difficult for them. And final, the MIPS implementation costs far exceed the potential for positive adjustments. The number of billings that they have, the ones that do not qualify for exemption, the number of billings that they have are very, very small, and yet the cost of the implementation in terms of implementing MIPS requirement far exceeds that. So I am going to share with you a tale of two cities. So the first tale is our MIPS negative ROI. So once upon a time, we had a very large and sophisticated clinically integrated network that had 30 to 35% rural providers, which means that they need an extra amount of time to be able to comply for MIPS. We recognize that we had to spend a lot of time in terms of helping our partners be able to comply with MIPS and able to deliver a high quality care in the areas that we serve. So we spent a lot of energy in terms of giving them extra resources. We hired staff. We spent side by side with their practices. We would actually go into their practice and sit down with all members of their teams. We hired dozens of additional full-time staff that we calculated we worked tens of thousands of hours to provide the education, the support, and the information, technology resources that was needed to meet the MIPS requirement. And we did so well that we ended up close to 95% when we got our MIPS score back, which made everyone, the 2,400 physicians, very happy, until we realized that 95% gave us 1.59% payment bonus. And that included the exceptional performance bonus in that. We calculated out what that was compared to the cost that we used, and it came out to 60%. So for every dollar we spent in complying with MIPS, we only got 60 cents back on it. And as you can imagine, that's not a sustainable system going forward. So the second tale is then we had to really look ourselves in the mirror and say, so what should be our next step? Do we stay in MIPS, in which we can hope that we can do better than 60 cents on the dollar? And or do we need to take a look at it from another perspective? And so the perspective we chose to begin to look at it is that MIPS has to be a stepping stone in terms of looking at the competencies to move into advanced alternative payment model. Without being able to get that 5% bonus in advanced alternative payment model, there is no way we can continue to survive in terms of getting 60 cents on every dollar that we put in terms of just complying with MIPS. So, thank you.
Thank you, Melinda. We'll have time for questions. I'm smarter now. I'm going to help Sherry get the slides up while she comes up here.
I had to do this. I thought it would just be easier. Okay, there you go.
You're good.
Yeah.
Right.
I told you, I learned quick.
There we go.
Excellent. Thanks. So I'm Sherry Erickson. I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs and Medical Practice at the American College of Physicians. We represent 153,000 internal medicine physicians across the country and some internationally as well. Our membership is made up of about half primary care general internal medicine specialists, as well as subspecialists in all different types of internal medicine, oncology, rheumatology, pulmonology, lots of ologies. So, and so we do have kind of a unique view on this because of the makeup of our membership. And even within the membership, our members are in academic centers, they are in track, you know, two ACOs. They're in pioneer ACOs. They're in small practices. I would say, though, that probably most of our members, a large, significant number of our members, are in the MIPS program. And that was expected, just as it was across all of the eligible clinicians that were participating or in MIPS. So I hear a lot about it from our members and wanted to reflect on some of the things that I've been hearing from our members and sort of give you some buckets of what those look like from their perspective and their experience within MIPS. So I kind of grouped it into a few different areas. And measures is a biggie. So, and this has come up. But I would say what I hear about most from our members is the fact that they really don't trust, they don't believe that these measures that they're reporting on are ones that are meaningful to them, their practice, and their patients. And I think that there's a lot underlying that, and that's not unique to MIPS necessarily, it cuts across, I guess, all of value-based payment programs. But it's something that I think we need to start to address, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as well. There are too many and yet too few measures. So, you know, when our Performance Measurement Committee looked at the measures that are included in the MIPS program, I think they found about a third of them are viewed as clinically valid. That should be, used by clinicians in the field. Yet, really, when you look at it more broadly than that, there are measures that are sort of in those other sets that are, quite frankly, maybe more meaningful to patients or to other stakeholder groups that are also involved in this process. So we need to be very thoughtful about how we look at those measures that are included in the program. And yet, also, there are too few. Some of our subspecialists really do struggle with having enough good measures that they feel are meaningful enough to use when they're reporting for the program or any value-based program. And then there are multiple alignment efforts. And I mentioned the work of our Performance Measurement Committee, but there's also work, within NQF to endorse the measures. There's the work of the MAP, which provides the pre-regulatory guidance to CMS. There's the work of the Core Measures Collaborative that has identified sets of core measures and is going to be getting up and running again soon along those lines. So in each of those movements, so to speak, or entities have had different approaches for actually very different, very good reasons because of the different stakeholders perhaps that are at the table and the different types of goals that they have set for themselves. And so we need to think about that, and I'll talk more about that in a moment too. Another big bucket is the health IT overall. Our members are very frustrated with the health IT, with the EHRs that they use daily. The usability of those is an extreme challenge, and particularly when you tie it into the need for reporting, at layers in additional what they feel are validly feel are very unnecessary additional clicks, additional data entry, re-entry of information, and the readiness of vendors, which is a real challenge. So the vendors, I think this came up earlier when Kavita was talking, have to upgrade, and then the practices need to pay for that and be sure that it's there in time for them, with a full year of reporting required for quality and proposed again to be required for quality. That's a real challenge if the health IT is not up to speed and ready to do that. And meaningful interoperability, and I put meaningful in quotes because meaningful is used all over the place in this town. But what I mean by that is that, we do need to share all the data, right? We do need to have those flows in place, and we don't want blockage of that data. But, when physicians really are taking care of a patient and they have someone in front of them, they don't need every piece of data about that patient in front of them. They need what they need to be able to pull at that time to help that patient in that episode of care. And that is where we need to try to get to. And that is not where I think that that we have gotten to yet. And it needs to be a place where we start to think very thoughtfully about what we mean by interoperability. There's a lack of clinician engagement and understanding. And when I think of engagement, I think of, so if you're in a larger institution, you have some leaders who may be physicians or clinicians, in a C-suite or somewhere thinking about what looking at all the data they have available and what are the real measures and what's the smart way to go about this? How can we do the best we can do in this program? But then you have the frontline clinicians thinking, well, they told me I have to report on this. I don't know why. It doesn't mean anything to me necessarily in this clinical encounter that I'm in, or in the 20 of them that I did today. So we need to figure out how to engage those clinicians in this decision making as well. And then when you get into smaller practices, less integrated systems, there's a real lack of understanding and ability to make those decisions with the same level of data, and then much less know how to report it because there are lots of different options and different timing around it. And then clinician accountability in what is a very fragmented system. Patients, maybe tied into their primary care clinician in terms of all of their chronic care for their multiple chronic conditions, yet they may have a need or a want for very valid reasons to see a different clinician, a different provider in another setting because of, maybe they're traveling, who knows, maybe they're just sick in the middle of the night and they need to go somewhere. And yet there's no really good way for that information, this gets at interoperability again, to necessarily get back to that primary care clinician on a consistent way for them to be able to then be accountable, then they're still accountable for the patient itself, themselves. And that happens across organizations and within organizations as well. The complexity of the program, I've hinted at that. It really doesn't need to be as complex as it is. There are certainly some parameters within the law that are required to be met. And then the scoring also doesn't need to be as complex as it is. The annual changes, this, I think, came up and will come up some more, not only lead to a lot of additional cost, they lead to a lot of additional confusion and lack of an ability for an organization, large, small, or in between, to plan ahead. And MIPS still does require sort of your feet in both boats. It requires you to be fully invested in fee-for-service. You still have to document every code. You still have to do all of that work while, by the way, trying to sort of inch your way into what's called value-based payment. And it's not easy to transition there. So is there still value? So I've laid out all these challenges, what I hear about on a regular basis from our members. And I would argue there is still some value in the program. The intent of the program is really to streamline and tie together some existing very disparate programs that were out there. And if you look at what's going on, ACP does quality improvement programs across the country. And I will tell you, those things work. When you implement those and implement them well, and they may actually mean that the physician or clinicians or the staff have to do some extra steps, document maybe some extra stuff even for that quality improvement work, but they don't generally mind that because they actually are engaged, they actually see that it's meaningful to themselves, to the patients, to the outcomes of those patients. So how can we figure out how to translate what we're learning there into the MIPS program? And alignment and improvement of measures, I don't think it's out of reach, but it's going to take real courage wrapped in compromise. All of us are going to have to think about that. We still need to fly this plane, but how can we actually make some changes to those measures? How can we actually get rid of the ones that are really not good measures, but also address the issues that many subspecialists or specialists are facing with not having enough, and get to a place where the measures are trusted, because there are some that are trusted and viewed as valuable by clinicians. How can we get to a place where we use as many of those as we can while also getting to the measures that are more consistent and useful and helpful to the patient? And so I think we just have to really think through how to do this and be a little bit courageous about it. I think MIPS can actually be simplified and streamlined. I think that there are more, and I could talk all day about that, but I want to also get to our other panelists. There are more pathways and more on-ramps that I think could be put in place to get to APMs, freeing up some of that work that's being done to rebuild, to do that so that Kavita's organization could actually invest in population health instead of having to rebuild based on the tweaks in MIPS. And then practices and systems can, and many actually do, take very thoughtful approaches to their decision-making around the measures that they're using and the approaches that they're taking. And we need to learn from them. They're not all looking just at the bottom line. Some of them really are engaging the clinicians on the ground and making very thoughtful decisions based on what they have available to do this work. So how can we learn from that, and how can we actually reward those individuals and groups?
Thank you, Sherry. All right, Erin, go ahead and come up here. We're getting got a workflow while I get the slides up. Okay, here we go. And then you should be good with this.
Great. I'm Erin Liss. I'm the Director of Strategy and Business Development with Tennessee Oncology. For those of you who are not familiar with Tennessee Oncology, we are one of the largest wholly physician-owned oncology practices in the country. We have over 80 oncologists, including medical oncologists, radiation oncologists. We have our own specialty pharmacy as well as a phase one research program through our partnership with Sarah Cannon Research Institute. My role there, I have in the 4 years or so that I've been there now, it's been primarily focused on finance related to value-based payment, as well as supporting our operational initiatives in our value-based payment programs in which we're participating. So I wouldn't refer to myself as an expert on the ACO program, but I think there were some interesting lessons from that program that are relevant to the APM that we are participating in, Medicare's Oncology Care Model, as well as to MIPS. And so one of the sort of things I would point out, does this thing work? No, it doesn't look like it does, you start to see a spike in groups who were successful in this program once you get about 2 years in, and then again at about the 3.5 year mark. So I think that just sort of illustrates the complexity of these, you know, new payment models, whether that's MIPS or whether that's a new APM, and how long it takes organizations to adapt without sort of multiple rounds of data and feedback loops, in that experience, it's really hard to, sort of get to that point. And these are organizations that self-selected themselves for having a high propensity for organizational change. In terms of sort of the impact of MIPS so far, I think one model, one framework we can use for that is to focus on the quadruple aim. For a second, I'm going to assume y'all can concede that workforce health is a severe issue. I'll talk more about that. I'm sure we're going to talk more about that on this panel. But in our analysis of the link between patient experience and these programs, we found that it's the gains we've made in patient experience in our analysis of internal surveys are made despite these programs, despite the attributes of these programs, and not as a result of those attributes. And I think that it's really, sort of the responsibility is on proponents of these programs to justify the cost to workforce health with the benefits to health outcomes and total costs of care that purportedly we should see in these programs. So, I think the high level intentions in terms of increasing provider consideration of costs of care and introducing performance-based variation in reimbursement, that's not a really sufficient justification for continuing these programs in their current form, because there's other more effective ways that we can accomplish those sort of fundamental objectives, I think we really need to, the standard really should be higher order accomplishments, such as feeling that reimbursement is commensurate with provider influence over outcomes, and really showing that these, you know, if there are, to the extent there are gains in costs of care and health outcomes, that those cannot be achieved some other way through some other type of program that doesn't have the level of burden on workforce health as well as patient satisfaction. And I think, you know, we've created a system with these programs that is, you know, increases the perhaps satisfaction of public health researchers with the granularity of the data that will be available, or for people who sell HIT systems, at the expense of providers being able to look up from the screen. And I think that, you know, that's, you know, we really have to be more thoughtful about how we are striking that balance. And then, you know, the in terms of organizational economics, you know, I would one of the interesting things about the APM in which we're participating is that we are required to report how we are investing in that program each year, and sort of very quickly it becomes apparent in that analysis that the cost of FTE time, it, you know, far exceeds any revenues that we, you know, garner from the APM or from MIPS. You know, to the extent that FTE time is about four times the cost of the FTE resources are about four times the revenue from combined revenue from MIPS and the APM. And you know, I'll concede that those are costs that we would, you know, we would take on to do something else for some other types of activities, as Kavita mentioned. But they are real costs to, you know, that we have to allocate, real time that we have to allocate to these programs. So, you know, I think basically as we increase the sort of multidimensional performance evaluation, all of the requirements we have to meet that are associated both with our APM and with MIPS, you know, we raise the resource investment necessary to perform well in these programs, and we reduce overall workforce health. And, you know, I think so far the, you know, that those two things are way out of balance. You know, we can't measure everything. We shouldn't need to report everything. We really need to be more judicious in terms of focusing on, you know, what's really important and what's really going to move public health outcomes and total cost of care. And so I think there was a really interesting article written by my co-panelists in Health Affairs that proposed sort of focusing on APMs as a you know, potential remedy for some of these issues that we're seeing for in MIPS. And I think that you know, that type of solution has a lot of potential, but sort of similar to the gap between intentions and reality that we've seen in MIPS so far, you have to get the structure of the APMs right in order for them to sort of render those benefits. When the downside, sort of the stop-loss downside of the APM is 15 times the small incentive we get from participating in an advanced APM, we haven't, we're not going to be driving provider organizations to those options in a way that we could if we balanced those issues, you know, appropriately. So I think that's as much as I'm going to cover for now, and we'll have time for questions.
All right. Thank you, Aaron. Let me get last but not least, Tim, get you set up here. All right.
Thanks, Kavita. All right, good morning. I'm really happy to be here today. So just a quick note about me and Caravan Health. I work at Caravan Health, and we are a company that helps health systems and physicians create and operate accountable care organizations, as well as operate other value-based purchasing programs. Before this job, I spent a number of years at CMS and on the Hill working on physician payment policy, among other things. And so I certainly am happy to shoulder my fair share of the blame for the MIPS design and operations. And so what I want to talk about today is I summarize what I think heard from people representing physicians and provider organizations, that MIPS isn't working if we were to define what we think Congress was trying to accomplish for the program. But I want to get to MIPS actually, I think, can't be made to work and to accomplish the objectives that Congress laid out for it, which I think if you listen to how people spoke about it, if you look at the design of the program, it's really intended to drive quality improvement, to drive attention to total costs of care. It's sort of like creating an alternative payment model for the entire fee-for-service program that is not in alternative payment models. But it was also designed with an intent to differentiate performance of physicians and try to measure at a physician and clinic level the performance, so that patients could use that information to choose physicians, high-quality physicians, and thereby reinforce quality improvement incentives. And it was also intended to create incentives to join alternative payment models, which offer a more direct and clinically nuanced way to support quality improvement and total cost of care. And so just to summarize what I think we're hearing the problems with the program today, it's very administratively complex and difficult to manage program from the perspective of a clinic or practice administrator. That requires a lot of staff time to deal with. It requires a lot of investment in IT resources. What we didn't hear was MIPS has motivated me to put in place the best industry standard PDSA cycles to identify the major needs of my patients. I think what we see often is that it motivates the choice of the easiest measures. And so that's really where I'm going to start of why MIPS can't be made to work. Congress laid out in trying to maximize physician independence and autonomy while also supporting quality improvement, a system where physicians and clinics would be able to choose the measures on which they're judged. It also allowed it set physicians in a position of having the single highest stakes value-based purchasing program in Medicare. And these are the smallest actors of significance that we deal with from a Medicare fee-for-service position. Medicare Advantage plans, effectively their value-based purchasing program is 5 points. In some cases, it's 10. These are giant companies that have the ability to manage that risk and to plan for it over a number of years, spending hundreds of millions of dollars in the process. While physician offices, the theoretical plus and minus for them, when you get out to 4 years implementation, is -9 to plus more than 30. And so that's a huge spread. And I think looking at the negative is the cleanest way. But even -9 is a really big number for clinics in a context where you then ask them to turn around and to do real quality improvement work. And as Sherry described, the measure choices that physicians face, there's a huge number of measures to choose from. And then in some subspecialty areas, they feel that they do not have enough measures to choose from. And I want to pull up a table from a paper that Kavita and I wrote, along with Matt and Fiedler and Paul and Lauren Adler and a few others, around what is the operations of MIPS likely to look like over the early years of the program based on what we knew from physician quality reporting programs that preceded MIPS and then essentially were rolled into MIPS. And so what we found is that if you look at this strong incentive to choose the easiest measures possible resulted even in a program where there was no attachment to your performance in the PQRS. It didn't matter what your score was in PQRS. But even with that, clinicians gravitated towards the easiest measures. And the number one measure by far in the program, and still to this day, is documentation of medications in the record. In many cases, you could argue that that's effectively a state law requirement. We have this giant apparatus built up now, spending hundreds of millions of dollars at the federal level and multiples of that in the private sector to encourage reporting of measures that are really easy in many cases or should arguably be basically standard of practice. Now, CMS, I will note, is aware of this and is trying to rotate out topped-out measures. But for reasons of political economy that I'm going to talk about a little bit more in a minute, that ends up being really hard to do in a sustainable way over time. So with this really strong incentive to choose the easiest measures, you end up with practices choosing the easiest measures, of course, but then not spending that time focusing on real quality improvement, but having their IT staff do quality improvement, turning it into a compliance exercise, not really looking at their total cost of care. excuse me. Let me see. Should I go to this? So the fee-for-service system that we have here Congress really faced a dilemma in, thank you, in the design of the program here that I outlined around clinician choice and the impact of the program, right? So the high stakes seems like, well, if you're dealing with a minus 9 to plus 27 or plus 30, it seems like that's a pretty strong reason to do well in the program. But if you pair that with measure choice, then you will have a really strong incentive to choose those easy measures. The alternative to that is what is done in APMs or in other contexts is to define a list of measures. Public-private cooperation, we need a lot of clinician input, of course, but in an ACO context, for example, there are 30-ish measures that are reported. About 15 of them are reported from clinical data, and the other half are reported from claims, and they're known ahead of time, and they're curated, and the organization can improve performance on them over time. Some of them are easy, some of them are hard, but it's a back and forth. You've got this situation where Congress, in trying to put in place a high impact program, wanted to give as much choice as possible and undercut their ability to do that with the choice. This is not something that can be fixed by tinkering, because you are always going to be looking to encourage that choice, and also because we have in our minds this: if we put in place the right incentives for these organizations, then they are going to figure it out. But paying physicians is really a lot more like paying employees or paying very small businesses in many cases. Not that physicians are employees of the federal government. Obviously, that's not the case. But they're not in a position to put in place the business processes that a hospital is, say, in the value-based purchasing context, where they are able to invest significant resources in quality improvement on a defined set of measures over time. This problem becomes even more clear, and this our paper goes into this in more detail, when you look at the construction of the cost measures that are an increasingly large part of the MIPS program. It started at 0% in 2017, up to 10% this year. CMS is proposing to take it to 15% for next year. CMS has gone through three batches of proposed measures in 3 years for that part of the program, and because you have to account for very small practices. They're looking at measure thresholds of 10 cases per year for some of the new episode measures, 20 cases per year. That is obviously going to be difficult to justify in terms of is that a good representation of any particular clinic's performance? It leads to huge disagreements with the medical community, and it's not something that can be solved with statistics or simply trying harder. This is going to be an intractable problem. You also have conflicting incentives in the cost domain, where hospitalizations are counted twice because they're counted in multiple episodes, and so it's truly a mess on the cost episode piece of the program. I'm going to wrap up here so that we can get to questions. But this is something that can't actually be fixed by simply tinkering the way we would normally try to improve. Some of the, say, an Innovation Center project can be modified every year or multiple times per year. Congress has revisited the hospital value-based purchasing program multiple times, and it is functioning more or less as intended. Hospitals are tracking difficult, in some cases, measures and improving on them consistently. We've seen reductions in readmissions, but it has also been tinkered with by Congress. In the case of MIPS, the costs of the ongoing program are very large in terms of wasted clinical time wherever we have physicians working on this program instead of focusing on their patients' needs. Significant administrative overhead in the private sector in particular, and also some lost urgency around moving to better payment models and payment models that can be made to work better over time. time. So from my perspective, and that's the argument of the paper, I still believe is true, it's much better for Congress to get involved now and to greatly simplify the program, to forget about trying to connect performance on a small and list of measures to large payment adjustments for physicians, and move to a simpler set of incentives to promote quality improvement processes and adoption of alternative payment models. I'm going to stop there.
Great. Thank you, Tim. And we'll go ahead and get started with just, I know we've got about 10 and we'll see where the conversation goes, maybe 15 minutes so that we can have a discussion. I'm actually going to start, I wanted to ask Aaron very briefly, just because I don't know if everybody understands, but I'd like for you to answer, if possible, at kind of a very granular level. You alluded to, you're in both reporting on MIPS, because you're also only in an advanced payment model, an alternative payment model, not an advanced alternative payment model, to get that 5% bonus. Just given everything that you described, how hard is your organization going to work to try to get an AAPM designation, or is that the goal? And you're speaking kind of not on behalf of oncologists, but certainly as specialists are looking at opportunities. So just very briefly, do you have a sense of whether or not, as an organization, the AAPM looks more attractive, if possible, to get away with this duality that you described?
The way the advanced APM sort of structure exists currently, I mean, I would hesitate to use the word non-starter, but, I mean, it's completely draconian in terms of the potential losses that a participant could incur on the downside, and you know, compared to the potential upside of participation. You know, having said that, we took the step of participating in a MIPS APM, for the reason that we are committed to moving towards, you know, value-based care and value-based payment programs. All of the practices who participate in the oncology care model, presumably a lot of those in the other CMMI models, self-select themselves for, you know, their intention to innovate in that way. But you do kind of hit this roadblock when the numbers sort of add up the way they currently do in these, with those two options. Is that what you were asking?
Yes, and then just very briefly, the MIPS APM, because you're reporting on both MIPS and you're doing the APM
right.
requirements.
Right, so the...
How much
through
time?
The APM... We aren't able to select the easiest measures to hit. The measures that we're measured against are sort of dictated by the structure of the APM, and the improvement activities are the most complex of improvement activities that we have to perform as part of the APM. And then we also have to do the advancing care. So we have much more stringent limitations in terms of options for participation in MIPS. But yet, despite all of the I should also mention that the clinical data reporting associated with the oncology care model is incredibly robust. It's very cumbersome. It takes several FTEs, working for several months to do that clinical data reporting. And then on top of that, we still have to do the ACI portion of MIPS. So I think that is one of the things that could be rethought.
All right, great. Valinda, you made several points, one around kind of the challenges of rural practices, and then you also kind of alluded to the desire to potentially find an advanced APM just for the sake of getting out of some of these challenges. So can you speak, what, number one, just to clarify, because I think a lot of people have a misperception that if you're, quote, rural, that you're really automatically exempt from these MIPS requirements. Do you mind just clarifying for the audience? And then number two, could you also speak a little bit, you know, we can't, Tim eloquently kind of described that MIPS can't just be tinkered with, and it really does need to be replaced, and maybe describe a little bit about how operationally at a health system of kind of medium to large size, how are you thinking about moving forward when you have to live in the current environment? Are you as a system trying to get an AAPM, and if so, what is your forecast on when that might occur? Yeah, you have to, yep, Aaron, press off, and then I know, I think only one can, okay, good.
Okay. So we have found that there's certainly a significant number of rural providers that meet the exemption category, but we should not assume the vast majority of them are exempt from it. And so, and even the ones that are exempt, particularly if they, those providers are not near retirement, they really understand that they need to get into the game. They need to understand how to work within this new environment. So even if they may complain about it, when you go into their office and, you know, they'll roll their eyes and say, there goes the government again. You can imagine some of the conversations we have. The vast amount of them say, I need to get an EMR. I've got to figure out how to work within this. And so one of the things that we have found is they're eager to join CINs to help them because they understand that they need assistance. Now, I do know CMS has provided some of that additional assistance, but it's not at the level, I think, that many of the rural providers are feeling comfortable with, and it's certainly not the level that somebody that's in their own town and goes into their office and drives to that rural city and sets there that they can provide. So with that, many of the rural providers around us have been very interested in being a part of the CIN so that we could assist them with that. We made the decision to go with a advanced APM, Track 1 Plus. We selected the one that had the least amount of downside risk. You can imagine with 2,800 providers and 30 to 35% of them in rural areas, we went to something that had the least amount of risk. And we're really glad that we made that decision after getting our 1.59% bonus. I will tell you.
But you made that decision without knowing that that was
right.
Right. So you had to make that organizational decision.
We were making it on the assumption that we would get around 3%.
Interesting. Okay.
We didn't think at a 2,800 person system that we would probably reach the top at 4%. So we were anticipating we'd come in between 90 and 95 and spending, you know, millions and millions of dollars. We probably spent close to $7 to $8 million in helping the system, the CINs, comply with it. And we, as I said, 60 cents on the dollar. So, you know, certainly a 5% bonus will help offset that, particularly from the employee docs, the independent docs and the rural providers will get that directly themselves. But that 5% bonus will, from the employed docs, will help the system as a whole offset all that investment we have put in for the system as a whole to move up. That CIN to move up in terms of competencies, in terms of population health.
Great. Sherry, you spoke about a number of activities. Obviously, the ACP sounds like you're supporting kind of quality improvement programs and more kind of collaboratives that are, it sounds like they're more meaningful. How, kind of thinking about what Tim mentioned with the struggle from a policy perspective with including a lot of measures for the sake of political economy, how can we transition potentially? Do you see an opportunity to take kind of the meaningful activities that are coming to the ground level, which I've been kind of using for the kind of clinical performance improvement activity bucket, in terms of meeting MIPS requirements. Is there something that should be translated into the broader quality measurement requirement or some way forward? Because I know when we've spoken before, we've all said we're not in love with MIPS, but don't throw it out without thinking about what to replace it with, which is also something Tim echoed. So what is it that we can do to bridge what you see happening on the ground and what we see at a policy level?
Sure. So I think that a lot of what's going on the ground with some of the quality improvement activities or improved quality improvement programs that are going on are really tied in to clinical guidelines and measures that have been viewed as valid. And I think one of the things that I think we could do, and I hear what Tim is saying about the issue of we can't just tinker with the program, I actually think there's quite a bit more flexibility than might be viewed, so to speak, by some in terms of what the law lays out and relative to what we can do. I think that we need to be pretty open-minded about that. So if one were to think about really taking a quality improvement activity, which includes the activity, right, that component of it, most of the times those activities do include using health IT in a meaningful way to do that work. They also include the measures, right, because you have to have measures to be able to measure whether your quality improvement activity or your quality improvement program is working. They also include looking at cost for the most part. So these programs are looking at those components. How can we have those types of efforts count across it all? I mean, that's really what's intended here, right? We had separate programs. We had value-based program. We had PQRS. We had, whatever else. We had meaningful use. Thank you. That's it. So we had all these programs that that were intended through the law to be brought together. Well, I think that, we still have in many ways, four siloed programs within MIPS. And I don't think it has to be that way. It just doesn't. The law doesn't say that it has to be that way. So I think that's what we need to do is be thoughtful about that. Let's look at how we can actually have things that individuals and programs and practices are doing and give them that credit across them. Maybe it's through even things like safe harbors for those that test this out for the administration to look, give them, ideas to be able to translate this into the policy that's needed to do it. I think that's one, practical way we could think about it, and there are probably a number of others, but I'll stop.
No, that's great. Thank you. And then, Tim, I'm going to give you a two-part question, but we'll close with a very rapid-fire panelist question. Our title of our talk today, our title of our program today is Can MIPS Be Salvaged? Sounds like we would probably answer as yes. Let me ask a different question. Were we better off before with those separate programs? And everyone's saying no, but that's, if I'll just get to that. And if you say, since we're all going to say no, let me ask it a different way. Are we better off trying to actually do what Tim suggested, where we need to probably replace the program? Or do we think that we can do what Sherry described with kind of taking pieces of it and looking at how to just make those pieces work in harmonization, et cetera? So I'm not going to load your answers. But Tim, two parts. One, the first thing you described kind of working, I think your organization works pretty critically with accountable care organizations of maybe different types. I'm not sure if they're all risk-bearing or kind of heterogeneous. Again, this question of do you think that, and largely not hospital-owned, I'm just going to venture, just knowing what I know, do you see a trend where these organizations see their path forward, as Valinda described, kind of in an AAPM, maybe a higher-level ACO that's taking risk, because that is one way to kind of keep moving along the continuum? And then the second part, I can remind you if we forget, is really around kind of in the backdrop, the trend towards consolidation, which is occurring across primary care and specialties. And certainly I don't see that slowing down, but you should tell us whether or not you think some of the kind of aspects that we've been critical of MIPS today might unintentionally drive consolidation in the provider market as well. So
I'll try to answer the first one quickly. So we work with different types of ACOs, including hospital and hospital-physician partnership ACOs. And many of them, are in ACOs partly because MIPS is so annoying to deal with, right? And so, but many of them are looking at the future and saying CMS is going to be making us take risk. We better get practice doing that. And, you know, see it as a better way, a more stable way to work on care improvement and total cost of care management. I think that the question around consolidation is a little bit separable from MIPS in the sense of Medicare has to figure out what it wants to pay for, define what counts as high quality, define what counts as reasonable and efficient payment rates, and pay that. I think Medicare is in some cases looking at site of care differentials where I think there's a pretty strong argument that payment differentials have led to consolidation. Those should be cleaned up, but that's sort of separate from MIPS. I think that you need to get the definition of what you want the program to reward straight, and then and empower people in the private sector, firms, people at hospitals and physician networks and all across the system to figure out solutions that are going to be efficient for them and for their patients rather than micro-engineering it like I think we do in MIPS.
Right. Okay, great. So I've taken the moderator's prerogative of changing my lightning round question. So what is, since we're going into the next panel to talk about kind of solutions and strategies, each one of you have mentioned several in your presentation. If you were kind of sitting at CMS today, you've heard all this feedback. Certainly there's the physician fee schedule rule, which has some provocative changes to E&M that I think are also going to color a lot of how we feel about MIPS, to be perfectly blunt. What is kind of the one top priority in, quote, salvaging MIPS? So it could be anything and even a repeat of what you said, but just the kind of the top thing. I'll go first. I'll say to expand the opportunities within advanced alternative payment models much more broadly, including opportunities for primary care. One has argued that ACOs offer that. They don't make sense for everybody, but expanding that portfolio in a meaningful way and harmonizing that with the MIPS requirements. Belinda?
My comment would be don't try to tweak a program that is not working. Hmm. I think that's always not a good time proposition for us in this industry. And I think we need to look at where we want to end up at and focus on modifying the program for that. And if we feel that population health risk-based contracts do improve the health of the populations that we all serve, then that should be the end point in terms of the modification of the program.
Great. Sherry.
Sure. So I think that you have to invest in making improvements in the current program because we have the current program. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I like what Belinda just said, though, about let's look at where our goal is and let's make those changes to it looking toward that goal. And I do think that what you and Tim wrote about in that article is very important, that there need to be more opportunities for clinicians, physicians to design and implement and be part of advanced APMs that can offer them really much more meaningful chances, I think, for making quality improvement and being rewarded for that quality improvement.
Great. Thank you. Aaron?
I think you have to make the performance evaluation portion of the element of these programs fair for, you know, they have to be highly targeted, as we've discussed, and they have to be understandable at the point of care. The more understandable they are at the point of care, the more successful they're going to be. And I think, you know, we have to leverage some of the work that a lot of the professional society quality programs have done. And, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, getting rid of MIPS and replacing it with nothing, because we already have things to replace it with. We have professional society quality programs. A lot of organizations across the country now are publishing case studies of their quality improvement efforts. You know, we've done that in areas of pathways and appropriate biomarker testing and responsiveness to patients via validated symptom management triage protocols. All of these things that can the folks who the care teams understand and see the value of them, and you know, will meaningfully improve care. You know, when you take away some of the burden, the reporting burden of these programs, you leave more space for those types of initiatives.
Great, thank you. Tim, final word.
Three things, although I would first say I think it mostly is on Congress to fix the structural problems with MIPS, not CMS. I think CMS
so you're in Congress. You can personally be a member of Congress. Yes.
No, I've already got my CMS answer. I can't change right now. The CMS needs to do what they're already doing in terms of reducing the administrative drag and cost of the program. It's got to be continuously made easier to deal with. They need to get rid of the easiest measures, the least important measures for patient care. That's going to be hard. They're doing that a little bit, but I think that there are too many measures in there that are not meaningful for patients. And they need to invest in alternative payment models, like you said, development, but also incentives for joining wherever they have levers in MACRA. I think that they need to be leaning it towards APMs rather than MIPS.
All right, Joe, I know we could go on and on. We have a great next panel, so we shortchanged them just a few minutes. But join me in thanking this current panel, and we'll switch out pretty quickly.
Okay, I'd like to begin our second panel and begin by introducing, you could take seats, please. This is the order in which panelists will speak. We're going to start with Jim Matthews, who's Executive Director of MedPAC, and he will describe the Commission's analysis and its recommendations on MIPS and anything else he'd like to say. Then hear from Matt Fiedler, fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution, and who worked with Tim Groniker to lead the analysis of the USC Brookings-Schaefer Initiative for health policy work that Tim put up in a slide. Then we'll hear from Sarah Levin, who's a member of the Democratic staff of the House Ways and Means Committee. And finally, from Robert Horn, now with Levitt Partners, but who served on the Republican staff of the House Energy and Commerce Committee when MACRA was developed. Jim.
First, I'd like to thank Paul and the staff of Brookings for putting on this event and for inviting me. I'm privileged to be here and thankful for the opportunity. I also, unlike the previous panel, I do not have slides, so you're just going to have to watch me talk for the next 5 to 7 minutes, so I apologize for that.
That's the case with all our panelists. I discouraged slides.
But it's a very nice background slide, so that should take some of the strain off. What I would like to begin with is I had originally prepared two presentations in response to the question of this forum, can MIPS be salvaged? And the first one went something like this. No. I'm happy to take any questions. In the interest of developing that thought a little bit further, I do want to represent MedPAC's current position with respect to MIPS and spend a few minutes talking about the evolution of our position. So we recommended eliminating MIPS in our March 2018 report to the Congress. Some of you may have heard about this. But I'm going to rewind for a little bit and talk about the origin of that recommendation. And it begins with a recommendation we made 7 years earlier to the Congress that the SGR system be eliminated. This was something the Commission had felt very strongly about over the years in terms of its impacts on physicians' willingness to treat Medicare beneficiaries and fully engage in the Medicare program. And so in 2011, we made a recommendation that included, you know, some fairly draconian payment updates for the, you know, decade ahead. And it was an indication of how strongly the Commission felt that the SGR needed to be eliminated. Congress did indeed eliminate the SGR in the MACRA legislation, and it was a tremendous accomplishment. We, again, were completely on board with the notion that SGR was serving no useful purpose. We also were very supportive of the new path laid out in MACRA with respect to alternative payment models as a mechanism to incentivize and help physicians engage in delivery system reform. So very supportive of that effort, and we're continuing to develop ways to improve the AAPM process. Then we get to MIPS. And MIPS, we were fully on board with the notion that there should be a value program available to non-organized, non-AAPM physicians. Many of our commissioners over the last several years had expressed this sentiment in very clear terms, and so we are very much in agreement with the goal. But over the last 2 years, we've come to the conclusion that MIPS is simply not going to achieve those goals. And I'll spend the next couple of minutes talking about why we believe that. When MIPS was first proposed on a regulatory basis in 2016, the Commission's position was that we would, you know, help CMS try to improve MIPS. But even at that point, we were raising some concerns about how it had been articulated. And we suggested focusing more on outcomes measures, reducing burden by using claims measures, and a number of other issues. But we still started to raise some doubts about, you know, the viability of MIPS as a broad quality improvement program for non-AAPM physicians. And over the following 2 years, as the agency continued to roll out regulations, refining the program, our concerns became even more pronounced, and we ended up concluding that MIPS is simply fundamentally not fixable as a broad value program for physicians. And there are a few reasons for this. And I want to emphasize here a broad value incentive program for physicians. First of all, there are numerous statutory and regulatory exclusions to the MIPS program. By rough estimate, we think currently 600,000 physicians are excluded as a result of regulatory decisions that the agency has made, and another 300,000 or so are exempt by statute. So almost a million are exempt compared to a little less than 600,000 who are subject to participating in MIPS. So in terms of a broad program to incentivize value, you've left two-thirds of your non-AAPM physicians kind of off the table right out of the gates. A second concern that we had is with respect to the small N problem and statistical reliability, that given the fact that you're talking about measuring the performance of individual physicians, even individual physicians who are subject to MIPS and who are selecting their own measures may not have sufficient volume to have their performance assessed in a statistically reliable way. So you're starting to move Medicare dollars around on the basis of random variation, and that's a point I'm going to get to in detail in a minute. We also had concerns about the low performance thresholds that I think the minimum performance threshold now is 15%, and the exceptional performance threshold is currently 70%. And I don't know about anyone in the room, but if one of my kids came home with a 70%, you know, average on their report cards, I would not call that exceptional performance. So we're talking about a very, very low bar for purposes of, again, moving substantial quantities of Medicare dollars around. We are also concerned about the fact that, as currently constructed, physicians will select their own set of measures, and this creates a couple of problems. One, you cannot equitably compare the performance of one physician to another. And again, this is a fundamentally unfair prospect, again, with respect to Medicare identifying one physician as being better than another one, and therefore you are going to get more dollars than you over here. Not you personally, but. There's also the problem of physicians selecting their own measures, and they will likely, or at least this is what I would do, select measures where I would have the best chance of performing extremely well. This is just human nature. So what's going to happen is you're going to get measurement compression, where you're going to see a lot of physicians performing at, you know, the 98th, 99th percentile on their different measures. And as a result, performance, good or bad, is going to be assessed on extremely fine gradations within, you know, a very high top of the spectrum in terms of their scores. And this is going to, you know, it might not make much of a difference now when the payment adjustments are, you know, in the 1-2% plus or minus range. But when you start getting into the negative 9 to plus 30, this is going to make a real difference. And as, you know, MedPAC has talked to different physicians out in the community, one very compelling anecdote we heard was, how do I explain to my family that I've just taken a $20,000 pay cut due to random variation? Big problem here. And then there's also the question of burden. So I think virtually everyone on our previous panel mentioned burden, no benefit relative to the cost, no return on investment. And CMS estimated close to $1 billion in compliance costs in the first year of MIPS, and we are projecting $500,000 annually in compliance costs on an ongoing basis as long as the program exists. And again, this is for a program that is not going to really measure performance at the individual clinician level. And, you know, a lot of the advocacy organizations will argue we've spent a lot of dollars, we've made a lot of investments into this, we can't stop it now. But, you know, how long do you want to keep throwing money into a program that, you know, is not going to fundamentally achieve its goals? And at the same time that some of the advocacy organizations are making this argument, others are, you know, having campaigns to their members that say, you know, one measure, one patient, no penalty, which in my mind does not sound like broad-based quality improvement and incentivized, you know, value on a broad basis. So on the basis of these concerns, MedPAC recommended in March of 2018 that MIPS be abolished and instead replaced by something that we call the voluntary value program. I'm cognizant of the fact that I'm running long on time, so I won't go into it in tremendous detail, but under this construct, groups of physicians can volunteer to be measured on a small set of population-based outcomes measures, similar to the measures that we have in mind for AAPMs. That's an important point. And under this construct, it solves at least four major problems with respect to MIPS. One, it solves your small N problem. You can only be measured if you've got a sufficient number of participants in your group. Two, it solves the burden problem. There is zero burden to this approach. Most of these measures are claims-based, which would be calculated by CMS, or there are patient satisfaction measures through exogenous surveys that could be used. It solves the equity problem. Each group of physicians is going to be measured on the same set of measures. And again, there's numerous questions and concerns about what MedPAC has proposed, and I could take that on question. But the last thing it, well, second to the last thing it does is it solves the value program. The measures that we have in mind are not things like, are you adequately assessing your patient's blood pressure on a regular basis, but they identify things that are important to the Medicare program and its beneficiaries. And then lastly, this approach does provide an on-ramp or some, you know, set of training wheels for clinicians to come together as groups on an informal basis under our construct. But since they are going to be measured on the same kinds of things that in our vision would apply to AAPMs, this does allow them to kind of try it out before deciding to go that next step and take on risk for the cost and quality of care for their aligned population. So with that, I will stop talking and turn it over to our next panelist.
Given that, as Tim alluded to, he and I have, along with Paul Kavita and a couple other folks here at Brookings, co-authored some work on this topic, it probably won't surprise folks that I am also on team Let's Abandon MIPS. I'll try not to repeat what Tim said, but I think there are three basic points that drive me to that conclusion. I think the first is that the empirical evidence more broadly on sort of value-based purchasing and pay-for-performance type programs that measure clinicians on a range of different cost and quality measures and then adjust fee-for-service rates upward or downward on that basis is just very weak. I particularly like there was some recent work by Eric Roberts and colleagues on the Value Modifier, which was a predecessor program to MIPS, that looked to see whether there were changes in physician performance at practice size thresholds where practices became eligible for bonuses or became eligible for bonuses and penalties under the Value Modifier. They found that there was no evidence of changes in performance at these practice size thresholds, which strongly suggests that these types of incentives were not, in fact, changing behavior. And that's not a unique finding to the Value Modifier. Lots of the research on these types of programs, including the Hospital Value-Based Purchasing Program and others, finds these programs to be fairly ineffective tools for changing behavior. So that leads me to believe that MIPS is likely to go down a similar road. Now, you know, perhaps you thought that these reflect fixable design flaws in these types of programs. I think for a variety of reasons that other people have touched on, I'm not optimistic on that front. I think the small numbers program that both Tim and Jim alluded to is just sort of fundamental here. You're going to have, when you're trying to do clinician or practice level quality measurement, you're just going to have very noisy measures. And that's going to mean the sort of amount of incentive kick you're getting for the amount of risk you're exposing providers to. It's just not a very attractive trade-off. I also think when you're in a world of clinician or practice-level payment adjustments, it's very difficult to create a coherent set of financial incentives that way. I think in the MIPS cost domain, we have a great example of that. We have a need to measure lots of different types of clinicians, and so the approach CMS has taken is do a bunch of different cost measures, throw them together, average them together, and that's your score. But because each dollar is going to, depending on who meets sample size criteria and which measure you're using, each dollar is going to be counted. Each dollar spending is going to be counted multiple times or not at all. The overall set of incentives we're creating to sort of think about the overall cost of care is pretty haphazard and scattershot. Some of that sort of problem may actually explain part of why these programs have been ineffective in that it's the scattershot set of incentives makes it hard for providers to figure out how to respond to them. It may also mean that even if providers did figure out how to respond to them, we wouldn't be thrilled with the types of responses we saw. And then I think if we have a structure that we think is unlikely to work based on prior experience that we probably can't fix, I think other people have alluded to the fact that it's not costless to operate this program. So, those administrative costs might well be worth paying if we thought we were causing real changes in quality or reductions in the cost of care. In a world where we're operating a program that seems to be pretty inert, they're very difficult to justify paying. So for those reasons, my view is that the evidence justifies abandoning MIPS. But if we were in a world where Congress were taking action to repeal MIPS, which may not be the near-term world we're living in, but maybe will be the world someday, I think this would be a good opportunity to implement other changes that might reduce the cost or improve the quality of the care. I think that probably will take a lot of different forms. I think as we move forward, there's been a little bit of a focus on silver bullets, and in fact, we're probably going to be looking at sort of multifactorial approaches to deal with many of these problems. But I want to focus on steps policymakers could take to make alternative payment models more effective in Medicare, given that APMs were the other main reform pathway that was envisioned in MACRA. So in contrast to the value-based purchasing programs, my read of the evidence to date on APMs, it leads me to be cautiously optimistic that these can be effective tools. On the bundled payment side, early evaluations of CMMI's voluntary bundled payments program, main voluntary bundled payments program, seems to suggest that these models can generate modest savings without impairing quality, though there does seem to be some variation from episode type to episode type, with surgical episodes, I think, at this point having stronger evidence of effectiveness. On the ACO side, I think the best work is probably by Michael McWilliams and colleagues looking at performance in the Medicare Shared Savings Program that, again, seems to find modest, but what I would call meaningful reductions in spending under ACOs alongside modest quality improvements. For a variety of reasons, my suspicion is that as providers gain experience with these models, the savings will likely grow. And I think there's also some reason to believe that as these types of models scaled, there might be systemic changes in sort of how medical practice and even medical technology involved that would mean that their long-run impact could be larger than what we're able to measure in the short term. So that's why I think this is a valuable road to go down. What do I think the sort of useful role for policy is beyond what we're doing now to make that possible? This is where I get a little more radical. I think one of the major barriers over the medium term to realizing the full potential of these models is that they are right now, for the most part, purely voluntary. That creates a number of challenges, but I think the biggest one is how to set provider spending targets. So the spending benchmarks in ACO models or the target prices in bundled payment models. Initially, these models have solved this problem by setting the spending targets based on providers' own historical cost experience. And that's a great place to start, but it's not a viable strategy. If you're a provider that's recognizing that, wait, if I save a dollar today, then when they reset my benchmark in a couple years, they're going to look back that I successfully reduced costs before, and so my future spending target's going to drop by a dollar. That's not a particularly sustainable financial model. It's not one that creates strong incentives. This approach also tends to lock in historical cost differences, which is going to reduce the incentives for efficient providers to expand and serve more patients and weaken the incentives for inefficient providers to contract. The problem is that the natural alternatives to that approach in the context of voluntary models have some real challenges associated with them. I think the most natural place, and the place that I know MedPAC and others in the context of ACOs have suggested going, is to set spending benchmarks, for example, based on regional average spending. The problem with that is in a purely voluntary model, providers with above average spending are likely to drop out of the model. Providers with below average spending stay in the model and realize big windfalls. So I think that does mean that over the medium run, if we really want APMs to be our key strategy, we're going to have to make these models less voluntary. That can, I think, be through a combination of carrots and sticks, and I think depending on the model, the right approach is likely to differ. On the bundled payment side, I think the right approach is probably ultimately going to be where we have models that we think work, actually making them mandatory. On the ACO side, it's not at all clear what it would mean to make ACOs mandatory or how you do it. So I think they're building on the bonuses for advanced APM participation that were in MACRA is really the right path forward. So I think step one is just to make sure that the 5% bonus doesn't go away in a few years. But I think beyond that, we should be thinking about making the financial incentive to participate larger. So would envision doing that through a budget-neutral combination of bonuses for participation and potentially ultimately penalties for non-participation. I think it's also a question whether those bonuses should should be limited just to physicians, as the APM bonuses under MACRA were, or whether we should be expanding those to additional types of providers in order to expand the sort of set of providers that has a stake in making sure that these types of models are operating in any particular community. So look forward to the conversation.
Hi, thank you very much for having me here. I need to start with a disclaimer. The views that I am about to speak are my own. They are not necessarily those of the ranking member of the Committee on Ways and Means, nor are they necessarily the views of the members of the committee. So on to that. I think that Paul and Jim touched on this, but it bears repeating, stepping back a little bit and remembering where we were a couple years ago with the near constant conversation of the sustainable growth rate. And, you know, SGR was started, as was discussed, in 1997. And since the early 2000s, there were repeated and regular cuts that were going to hit physicians that Congress had to stave off. And this would bring the physician communities to Congress saying, please don't have these cuts, and beneficiary groups saying, please don't cut my physician payments. I want to make sure I can still see my physician and be able to still see my doctors. And the conversation in healthcare was largely, in the Medicare space, was largely talking about how to get rid of the SGR and how what we can do next. And so over the course of that period of time, Congress spent about $170 billion on short-term patches. And in 2015, the physician community was facing a 21% rate cut. And so in comes MACRA. And in the time post-Affordable Care Act, this hyper-partisan healthcare discussions, here's this bipartisan bicameral work that is looking to talk about value of care and drive, and the whole point of MACRA and you know MIPS and the advanced APMs was to talk about how to move to a system that rewards value of care instead of volume of care, and that's a change of conversation from you know how do we stop these cuts to how do we move to value? And it's reflective in this community right now to talking. We're talking about how do we make sure that we're improving care for beneficiaries and doing it in a meaningful way for the an easier way for the physician community. So Congress established MACRA, which created this two-pronged approach. One is the advanced alternative payment model for those who are willing and able to take on risk for their payments. And those, a large section of the physician community who was maybe not quite ready to take full on risk, but, you know, maybe interested in value. And we heard loud and clear from the providers that not every doctor is the same. And there is variation in the readiness to move to value. There's variation in size of practice. There's a one-man shop. There's several hundred-person shops. There's location that, you know, what a physician practice in Iowa or Tennessee, it looks differently maybe than one in New York City or Houston. And so there's also the physicians would come and say, you know, I am different from another physician. You are going to measure my quality. I'm a pathologist. I don't see patients. How are you going to change my payments? I'm a family practice physician, so I care about, you know, maybe these flu shot measures are relevant to me, but maybe a surgical measurement isn't relevant to me. So how are you going to make sure that any value proposition can speak to me? And so there are a lot of challenges, and since the physician community is diverse, and both in you know size, scope, geography, what types of services and they furnish, trying to make a program that encompasses us all, and you want to make sure that there's opportunities for everyone to succeed and to continuously push towards that value. And so MIPS is an important part of that package to lead towards an on-ramp for those who are, may not necessarily be ready to move to value in 2015 or really the onset of MACRA, which started in 2017. than giving people the opportunity to do so. And this is, it's a marathon strategy, really. And there are those who started who are more integrated practices who have been doing this bearing risk for quite some time, started at mile 26 and only had 0.2 to go, and really, you know, understand and have the systems and capabilities in place to move towards that value in a more advanced way. And then there are those who are not even at mile one, and we, you know, need to have set up a system so they're not keeling over before they get to mile 10 or four. You know, there are those who talked about here in the earlier panels that there is MIPS can be used as an incentive to move towards that advanced APM, and that's really the goal, is to try to get everyone an on-ramp or movement towards those advanced APMs. And there's been a lot of concerns that are valid that have been talked about, and they're continuing to talk about here and in Congress. How do you measure performance in a meaningful way? How do you continue to push the outcomes-based measurements that are meaningful for physicians, that are meaningful for patients, and saying, how can I improve care? Or what type of care am I going to receive? And that is an ongoing process and something that needs to continue to be developed and moved on. But I will say that there, right now in Congress, that's the conversation, is how can we make these improvements? How can we move towards more value? How can we move towards outcome? And the conversation has not yet been how to dismantle MIPS. And I think that, you know, just remembering that this was the MACRA, MIPS and advanced APMs, was a bipartisan solution that came after over a decade of short-term patches and a long broken system. And this is year two of the program. MIPS really started in 2017, and we don't even have the results from the first year. Payment consequences haven't started. They don't start until 2019. And so we don't know how the program is working. We're very interested in how the program is working. There, we've had, in our committee, we've had several hearings on the implementation of MACRA. We had one earlier this year. Energy and Commerce Committee is having one next year. Congress has invested in making sure that it works and that it could be useful. We've made some technical changes earlier this year in the Bipartisan Budget Act, specifically dealing with providing more flexibility to physicians and more time to on-ramp, and to clarify some terms that were confusing and wouldn't allow the flexibility that we want physicians to need to use. But additionally, there were clarifications relating to the development of new advanced alternative payment models and making sure physicians have technical assistance to get to the point of developing those value-based models that both the physician community and, you know, beneficiaries want to see. Because we do want to, the whole idea of this is to lower costs and improve quality. I think it's very important to hear all the perspectives on the different challenges. And I would say that, you know, the statute is pretty, there's been a lot of regulatory issues that have been discussed here. And I appreciate the discussion of that that Sherry talked about. There's a lot of flexibility in the law. But when we talk to the physician community and the beneficiary community, they're not coming in banging down the doors to repeal MIPS right now. They, as in the way that they were in SGR, they're coming down talking about how can we, I need an advanced alternative payment model. I don't have one. How can I get one? How can I, and that's a good conversation to have. How can we make the measures more relevant? How can we drive to allow more people to have this the ability to bear risk and to do more advanced alternative payment models, and to even do the alternative payment models that hopefully lead down the road to those advanced alternative payment models? And so this delivery system focus is important. And so we can bring everyone down the road, MIPS using that on-ramp to get to the point where we can have those bearing risk discussions, because again, that small rural practice or small urban practice they're very different than the large integrated medical practices that have all the data analytics. And so moving everyone along is really the goal. So I'll stop there and turn to Robert.
Well, first and foremost, happy Friday, everybody. Look, I had talkers. I've completely iterated around those now. So let me just start this way, and I'll kind of go back and forth. First off, just let me note, I'm a Chicago optimist. It's a tough value proposition living in a town of absolutists, but that was a bad joke, by the way. I want to switch the question around a little bit that we were posed today. And I first want to talk about how MIPS and larger than that physician reporting can be improved and utilized as a tool of driving value. And then I want to answer whether MIPS can be saved or not. Two things to note, and really one to build off of Sarah. MACRA was a bipartisan law. It's still a bipartisan law. That's a really important part in this town and point in this town, because modifications, improvements, and areas to support the law are still very bipartisan. But as we think about basically MACRA and the role of physician reporting in a value proposition, it largely, MACRA was created to get away from the SGR budget tool that was utilized around the inflationary updates on the physician fee schedule. And it was created to allow for physicians to help drive value in the Medicare program, where before some might have thought of it largely as an ACO proposition. And so you could think about MACRA 1 as helping the physician community drive what the future of value looks like, and it's something that is still a very bright proposition. But number two, it could be thought of as defining the ways to measure those value propositions. And that's largely what you could think of as MIPS and the APMs. APMs are the value proposition. MIPS, in some respects, are ways to measure that value proposition, knowing that reporting is going on in an APM as much as it is MIPS. My humble opinion, MIPS is not just a measurement tool, though. It's also an opportunity for data aggregation, gathering, and the effective employment of data to support the identification and adoption of value propositions. My dad basically bought a new car, first-year model, when I was 6 years old, and he was so excited. He brought it home. He was bragging about it. 6 months later, that car was no longer in our front driveway because it had problems. It broke down, basically, and it got fixed. The funny thing about the car, it's a MIPS analogy, obviously, is that it was back in the driveway 3 weeks later, and it worked well. It really did. To Sarah's point, there are a lot of flexibilities in the MIPS program itself that can be utilized to improve physician reporting as both an opportunity to define what measurement looks like, but also as an opportunity to give CMS, CMMI, and others the data that it needs to identify and define what new value propositions look like. We may not necessarily be utilizing those tools as effectively as we can, but the flexibilities that Sarah spoke to can do that. One example, and Sherry brought it up, the combination of CPIAs and the reweighting of measurement categories within the law, if combined, can help define what new value propositions are from a measurement standpoint and also potentially an APM standpoint. Those aren't the only flexibilities. There's a lot of flexibilities. If you consider, too, the flexibilities that CMMI affords the administration, you can almost double those opportunities. Congress, as well, is not a passive participant in this. My guess is if somebody walked forward with a way to make the MACRA program more meaningful, that wouldn't be a conversation that they would shut down. And I'm not speaking for them. Sarah can speak better that than I can. I no longer work there. But in thinking about basically MIPS in some respects, too, let's think about the role of physician reporting beyond MIPS. Physician reporting can be a way to really identify what new value propositions are in the APM pathway. One of the areas of improvement that could be focused on are opportunities to tie the MIPS pathway closer together with the APM pathway. And it's an area of policy that I am working on with a broad stakeholder community, because I do believe that MIPS can be improved upon. I do not believe in the absolute statements that it should be gotten rid of. I think for anybody that points out a problem with the MIPS program, I would encourage them to think of a solution, not necessarily just a let's throw it away. And again, MIPS and the MACRA statute are not an SGR budget tool. They really are ways to harness and drive value. But one example of how physician reporting can be utilized better under the MACRA statute to drive the identification, adoption, and use of value propositions in the Medicare program is to allow physician reporting to report more on what we could call prototypes of what measures look like and what APMs might be. An APM largely is a behavior change, some other stuff wrapped around in the middle, and a payment change. The proposition is based on if you accept more risk, we can allow you to do things in a different way that bring value to us all. CMS largely right now, CMMI and others, they need information. They need data. They want to figure out what works and what doesn't. One of the areas under the MACRA statute right now that was designed to deliver data to CMS, CMMI, and CBO was PTAC. Now, it was envisioned much different than it ended up, and it ended up where it was because staffers had visionary ideas of what second pathways could look like, and then we ran into the realities of CBO scoring, and rightfully so, I think, pointed out some of the flaws in what we had considered. But the point is, there could be a second reporting option. There are flexibilities to implement it that would allow physician organizations to put forward prototypes of what an outcome measure could look like, of what an episode could look like, or what an APM could be. Identify ways to report on those prototypes that facilitates the data gathering for CMS and CMMI to help them better understand whether there's a value proposition that is worth exploring for purposes of payment. If you use the physician fee schedule to do it and reporting, you get to do something interesting. You don't have to apply payment consequences to it, which means largely every physician in this country could be reporting on a prototype. The information that they're reporting would help inform CMMI, as an example, about what projects it should select, with the goal of being more accurate in terms of the projects that it does select. In areas where the proposition fails, we've also largely succeeded because CMS and CMMI now know what doesn't work, but they may be able to extrapolate from the failed what might work in the future and then put it forward again. And lastly, you have increased provider confidence in the MACRA statute and found ways that they can better align their incentives with CMS's around identifying what the future of value looks like. The reason for the bad analogy in my dad's car was largely because MACRA is my dad's first year model car. It didn't work. I mean, it was a self-edit. It was not a great car. But the thing is, that car was in my family for 12 years after it got back from the shop, and it really didn't have problems. The funny thing is, and I won't, again, mention the auto maker, but model year 2 and 3 and 4 didn't have the problems that model year 1 did. To Sarah's point, the flexibility and bipartisanship in MACRA is a huge opportunity, basically. And it's a huge opportunity to utilize the entire Medicare program as a driver of value versus self-containing, let's say, all of the potential and just an area like CMMI. Going forward, my hope is that we can all engage in a conversation over how to improve the law in ways that make it a more effective driver of value. I'll stop there. Thank you very much, and happy to answer questions.
Yeah, thank you, Robert. I came into this panel with a couple of questions, and I think they've been answered pretty well by the panelists, so let me not have them repeat it. First, I want to ask the panelists if they have anything they'd like to say, inspired by what other panelists said, and then I'm going to go to the audience, which did not have a chance to ask questions after the first panel, and I want to make sure you do after this one. Any comments? Okay. Yeah, there's a woman there with her hand up. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
My name is Jennifer McLaughlin with the Medical Group Management Association, which represents practice administrators. And to build on comments made by Sarah, Robert, and Sherry in the last panel, we've done a lot of work with the physician community, cardiology, AMA, to coalesce around this idea of multi-category credit. And I would especially be interested in your thoughts, Sarah, Jim, Robert, as well. Some of the pushback we've gotten from officials in the administration has been that this would be the equivalent of double dipping because the statute lays out four separate categories. You have to separately report within each of them. But if, for instance, CMS did want to incentivize reporting around really important issues like take the opioid epidemic, and there were quality measures or improvement activities, potentially some cost lever, that's less likely right now, but absolutely a CERT component. And they wanted to bundle that and allow group practices to report once on the activity that they're doing, say to consult prescription management drug program within their state, report that information to the public health registry, and document that through quality metrics, through improvement activities, through use of CERT. Our request to CMS was recognize that as a comprehensive sort of bundle, if you will, within MIPS, and don't require group practices to put in all of the burdensome requirements to separately meet those three different buckets, but rather just allow them to say, we're doing this important work. Can we get credit across the MIPS program? The pushback again has been that could be perceived as double dipping. What are your thoughts on that?
So I'll answer this somewhat amorphously, but understanding I haven't seen all the details, let's say, of the proposal. Look, I do think, again, just to go back to Sherry's point, I don't want to put too many words in her mouth, so, but there is a lot of flexibility in the law to think about those four categories not as separate categories, but as areas, let's say, of measurement and activity that in some respects could be relied upon for the purposes of measurement. And again, the reweighting flexibilities that are in the law, if you look closely at the language around the reweighting, do allow for areas of condensing those four categories into smaller amounts of categories. It's largely wrapped around CPIA, but you know, the interpretive powers of the administration, basically, and the intent of Congress was always, we don't necessarily want to formulaically think about these four categories as simply four categories. Now, I will say this. I think the administration and others are still feeling their way around what is a very complex but very dynamic law. And so I think from an organizational standpoint, opportunities to engage the administration and Congress in what the opportunity is, but also maybe how to support it, can be an effective strategy for exploring new ways.
Other questions? Yes. And then there's, the next one is this gentleman back there afterwards.
I would just add that, you know, I think the idea of MACRA in general was to streamline and to really and to think about different ways to make reporting easier while also making it more useful and value based. And so, I don't know the specifics of your proposal or your CMS's challenges, but even having different activities that you're doing within those four buckets, they could be all. Even if you're doing them within the four buckets, they could be aligned towards the same goal, which is really what the intention is supposed is to, you know, drive value, whether it's in the opioid sphere and reducing those unnecessary prescriptions or others.
Yeah, let's hear from Aaron Liss.
Yeah, so I think Matthew brought up a very critical issue that I think has been understated throughout the morning, which is the importance of benchmark setting and target price setting and getting that right and having that be having those target prices and benchmarks be equitable. There was one element of it that I didn't hear that I think is a very significant concern. I was wondering how the panel would propose addressing this, but that is the degree of innovation in therapies and in diagnostics that we've seen over the past several years is fundamentally different than a lot of the data on which these models were based. And I think that I'd be interested in hearing your all's perspectives on how to account for that. To me, it it just seems like that is it requires a degree of technical expertise in various specialties addressed by these APMs that's hard to get and hard to account for in the design of these models.
So a couple, share a couple thoughts, but I think to some extent this is just a hard technical problem that we don't have perfect answers to. But I think there are two broad approaches you can try to take. One is in terms of growth rates over time, instead of is doing sort of more peer benchmarking of growth rates. So insofar as everyone's being affected by the same technological changes, that at least to some degree can capture those sorts of trends. Now, I think the challenge is you've got to really make sure that the peer groups you have for any given practice do have the same patient mix and are being affected by those technological changes in the right and in the appropriate in the same way. So I think that's a challenge. I think the other approach, and I think this becomes a bigger problem on some level, narrower the models you're talking about are, right? If you've got a broader patient population, hopefully some of this averages out a little bit more, where there may be more technological change in this area of care, but not as much in that one. It's one of the reasons that over the long run, I tend to think that it's one of the advantages of total cost of care models over sort of episode-focused models, because I think they may be more robust to some of these challenges, but... I think there's no perfect solution.
Okay, there's a gentleman back there.
Hi, David McNitt with National Health Advisors. I appreciate Robert and Sarah's points about where we were with SGR and where we've gone with MACRA, and the physician groups that I work with are very appreciative of the change and what Congress did to pull us out of that morass of constant SGR fixes. And I think that even though we appreciate what MIPS is trying to do, we do sort of look at it as value purgatory, that we're sort of there as we wait for the advanced alternative payment models to come online. And we realize that's going to be a process. But by and large, the physicians I talk with, they don't just want one APM. They want multiple APMs. They want multiple on-ramps. And my question for those on-ramps sort of comes back to Dr. Fiedler. You made some comments about the mandatory nature of APMs. And I'm kind of wondering where should those lines be drawn? Should it be that you're on the MIPS track and then there's one on-ramp to APMs and you make that one APM mandatory for that group? Or do you wait for multiple options to be ready and say, okay, this clinical space has enough options for most of you to be in the APM track? And I think we're seeing it sort of play out with CJR being the first mandatory bundle, but also with BPCI Advanced coming online, for those physicians that are in CJR MSA, but are actually being successful under the BPCI model, that they do not have the option to continue on into the BPCIA model. They're actually being forced from a successful BPCI experience into CJR. And that's sort of another wrinkle to that mandatory aspect. And how do you see that playing out?
So I think there are two broad philosophies here in terms of whether we want broad choice of APMs or whether we want to really focus around a small set of models. I tend to be on the focus around a small set of models camp, and there are three reasons for that. One is I worry about a proliferation of a lot of different models just being a very complex environment, both for providers to navigate and for policymakers to manage. I think the second is, I think in many of those cases, I worry about balkanization, where we've got very narrow focused models that, because different types of clinicians and different types of providers are very focused on the measures and financial performance in their particular models, that we're inhibiting what in many cases is cross-provider type collaboration that we think we really want to foster. And then the third challenge is a major just arbitrage concern. That I think if we've got providers with a menu of three or four different models to choose from, inevitably some the financial terms of some of those models are going to be idiosyncratically more attractive to them than the others. They're going to choose those, and I think that may be very good for the providers involved, but I think it could be very costly for the Medicare program. And so I think that tends to lead me towards a place of what we want is a fairly restricted menu of models that we can then find ways for a broad array of clinicians to find ways to engage with and enter into.
I'd like to maybe speak to that as well. I have a slightly different take. It's not to disagree at all, but look, I tend to think that more options are better. How you get to more options, I think, is a very important question, and there should be integrity in that. I would suggest right now that APMs largely, ACO specifically, the cost savings potential is largely undetermined at this point. I think the data supports that. I think we all see the potential and agree with the proposition that a new value proposition can save money. I think one of the downsides of focusing on a small subset are that you limit your chances for success and actually defining what that savings is. I think in part two, what I'd love to see is maybe an initial focus on some areas where a small set are there, but where the strategy is to identify components of those models that can be replicated for the purposes of allowing a little bit more individualization down at the provider level, both from a standpoint of specialty focus, but also geographic location and ability. Subspecialty right now, they may never get to an APM the way we're going right now. So in some respects, you're almost creating a second class of citizen among the physician community, where the system is focused on value and they have no ability on their own to drive it. Number two, I would suggest is that if we focus on small subsets and we continue on that and we utilize CMMI as the only approach, we run the risk of by the time we identify a model 7 to 10 years down the line, it's already outdated. Component approach in some respects allows us to look a little bit farther in the future. And again, I think there are ways in which physician reporting can help on an iterative basis inform what next generation models look like 10 and 15 years down the future. Largely, I'll end with this, I think. I agree with you that MIPS today can be improved upon. I really do. I would also suggest that providers that are waiting under the current system for their place on the APM pathway could be waiting for 20 or more years. And I don't necessarily know if that's a sustainable place either.
Yeah, actually, as a final thought on this particular discussion, seems as though the big choice in APMs is whether to emphasize population models. And not only emphasize, you know, versus episodic models, which I agree with Robert, they're going to have to be customized to lots of different specialties. But to me, that's the weakness of that approach. And the population approach could include, and I would hope would include, the flexibility for those, say, like ACOs, taking the population risk to actually innovate in the payment for particular episodes that are important to them and figure out how to do it their way rather than doing it through the regulatory channels, which take so much longer. I was going to close the meeting, but you seem eager enough to say something. So.
Hi, I'm a fourth-year resident physician at Georgetown, and I did my MBA on value-based care. What are your? I work very close with my medical society, which is the AAPMNR Medical Society. And one of the big issues that I think we really should expand upon are building registries and making that more points on the scorecard. Because I think if we have registries that are meaningful and have like more measures within the registry that can capture data for evidence, for we can build episodes of care, and I think once we have that, we can really build APMs. What are your thoughts about expanding upon registries for each specialty society?
Well, I would say that there are registry pathways built into the law as a recognition of the usefulness of the data that is inputted into the registries, and also that the societies have developed and created as specific to the type of work that specific medical profession engages in. And so I think that, Congress found the value in them and included them as a result of that. So there are obviously implementation questions that are being considered and changes that are even being considered in last week's new regulation that CMS put forth. But the use of the information that is put in there and it can provide some information that you, some answers to some questions that I think that are useful that you discussed.
Actually, if I can just maybe add to that a little bit too, it's funny that registries, and Sarah knows this, it's probably the most often used word in the macro statute. I mean, it's everywhere. It became a joke among the committees at one point because everything was and registries. But there was a reason for that too, and it's somewhat more of a hope for ways that registries could be utilized. And so I think, sir, to your question, the question becomes how they're recognized, not so much just the recognition themselves. But ultimately, CMS has a computer and capability problem in that CMS doesn't have the modern analytic capabilities that private businesses and organizations do. Somebody once told me that it has a 1980s computer system that's basically still an Apple IIe. It's not to denigrate CMS at all. It's not, but its ability to evaluate the value is limited. Registries empowered with modern analytics could be one potential, let's say, to improve CMS's ability to opine on whether a value proposition works or not. And recognizing registries as a conduit for gathering and submitting data to CMS might create shared opportunities for both the physician community and CMS to not only have the data, but also understand what the data is telling us. And again, I think it comes down to how the recognition happens, but if done in the right way, it could be pretty powerful. I agree with you.
One thing I would add here is just there's a strong, registries have a strong public good aspect in that there's going to, they enable a lot of types of research and learning that has systemic benefits that are potentially, beyond the level of the individual clinician. And so I do think, even if you were in a world where, where I got my wish and MIPS went away, I think maintaining some incentive for registry reporting would have a strong rationale for it.
And if I could just weigh in very quickly on this point as well, speaking for the commission staff, not the commission as a whole just yet, we are contemplating the role of registries in overall, physician value improvement activities. And some of the things we would be concerned about if these become a vehicle for moving substantial amounts of Medicare dollars around would be, what kind of data validation efforts occur on the front end? How open are these things? How accessible is the data to, the research community, to policymakers? What activities do the owners or managers of the registries do to push that information out in some aggregated form to the people who submitted it in order to ensure that it is indeed being used for purposes of quality improvement, practice improvement, as opposed to just sitting in the registry as a black box, allowing a submitter to say, yes, I participated in a registry. So we think there is probably some potential there, but we would want to see how that information is actually used to drive change before we would buy into this as, again, a vehicle for moving Medicare dollars around.
Thank you. One final thing on registries. I'm a public trustee of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, and it's been exciting as that academy has developed a very successful registry. And it is going to really advance knowledge about what works and what doesn't work in ophthalmology, besides all the other things about giving feedback to physicians as to how they're doing. I'd like to thank this panel. They've done a marvelous job, as well as the earlier panel. I want to thank Lauren Adler and Abby Durack of the Center for Health Policy staff for planning this conference and supporting it. And finally, to the Schaefer Initiative, USC Brookings Schaefer Initiative for Health Policy, for providing the funds to pursue it. Thank you all very much.